You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 2nd of October 2017 on Monocle 24.
Live from London, this is Midori House on Monocle 24. I'm Andrew Tuck. Today, at least 58 people are dead and hundreds more injured after a man opened fire on a crowd at a concert in Las Vegas, Nevada.
All of a sudden, we just heard like three or four little pop, pop, pop. And everybody kind of looked around and said, oh, it's just firecrackers. And then we heard pop, pop, pop. And it just kept going and going. And my husband said, that's not firecrackers. That sounds like a semi-automatic rifle.
To the families of the victims, we are praying for you and we are here for you. And we ask God to help see you through this very dark period.
President Trump will visit Las Vegas on Wednesday as the United States comes to grips with one of the worst mass shootings in its history. We'll have the latest developments and analysis from our studio guests. Also ahead, reports suggest that Catalonia might declare its independence from Spain within hours. We'll ask why and what happens next. And we'll look at how attitudes towards same-sex marriage have evolved in Germany after the first weddings took place at the weekend. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. Well, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Marie Bion, the UK correspondent for French media, and Tim Marshall, editor of the whatandthewhy.com, and also the former diplomatic editor of Sky News. Welcome both to the programme. First to Las Vegas, where at least 58 people are dead and hundreds more injured following a mass shooting. US media reports that the man inside a room of the Mandalay Bay Resort and Casino fired at a large outdoor concert, sending people gathered outside running for cover. One witness told ABC News of bullets raining down around him.
Oh, we were just at the concert there and Jason Aldean was playing and kind of sounded like some fireworks going off. And then I think there was like the first kind of volley, and then all of a sudden the second volley, my buddy's like, I just got hit, you know, and got hit three times. And then people started diving for the ground and it just continued and it was pretty much chaotic. Lots of people got hit. Lots of people were getting, it took a while to get him out. We had to get him over the fence and hiding under the stage for a while, you know, to be safe. And finally we had to move him because he had three chest wounds. And got him out here. We got four people in the back of a truck, but then we got turned around because there was an active shooter. So we couldn't go down the street. So we finally got an ambulance right here on this right across the street here. And got two of the guys in, and basically the one guy ended up dying in my arms because he was bleeding. And my buddy got in there. We got three more people on the ambulance, and so I just got a message, my buddy is going to be okay.
An eyewitness to today's mass shooting in Las Vegas. Well, earlier today, President Donald Trump called the attack pure evil, and he said that he would visit Las Vegas on Wednesday.
Last night, a gunman opened fire on a large crowd at a country music concert in Las Vegas, Nevada. He brutally murdered more than 50 people and wounded hundreds more. It was an act of pure evil.
Tim, we haven't quite been here before. This is a huge number of people, but the narrative coming out of the United States we have seen again and again and again. And despite the horror around this, do you think, especially with President Donald Trump in power, there's going to be any real change in the way that guns are allowed to be bought and used, the way that America is policed, or that security is run at venues?
It's shocking because the death toll is so high. That will fade. It was high at Columbine. It was high at Orlando. This is the highest. Previously, it was the terrorist attack on the gay nightclub in Orlando last year. When this fades, the same arguments will still be there. Well, it's the people that kill. It's not the guns. The NRA will still be as powerful. The Republicans are still in charge. So when this fades, I don't see that things will change on gun laws. What might happen is there'll be a debate about security in getting weapons into clubs, nightclubs, restaurants, you know, a debate they've had in Israel and gone down a certain road. So I think that is the only change that will happen, because whether it's terrorism or a crazed loner, the argument still comes back to guns. This man apparently had up to 10 weapons in his hotel room. How did he get them in there? So I think it'll be diverted into security, not into gun control.
But just on that, Tim, it's clear that in many cities, including in Nevada, some clubs do a pat down, some venues do a pat down, but often you can just waltz in with your guns, and you can often stay in hotels because you're checking in your guns and saying, you know, I've got them with me. There's not a ban on having guns in hotels.
That's it. I mean, and also even in Israel, where, you know, if you go in a restaurant frequently, you'll be patted down or go through even a metal detector. When you check into a hotel, you don't. And yeah, your point is absolutely valid. You'll still be able to go up to the 32nd floor and point a rifle out of a window. But as I said, I just think that I can't see the gun laws changing. We've had this debate every single time this happens, and it's never come close to changing, and I don't see that happening now.
Marie, in France, we know that we do have quite strict gun laws, and we have attempts to stop these things. But still, in Paris, the attacks happen as well. Do you feel that legislation, in the end, it is much of a break or a barrier to these things happening? Because it has happened in France.
Well, it has happened in the Bataclan. It was kind of the same scenario. Someone or people at the time shooting in the crowd during a concert. That France thinks a lot about what happened in the Bataclan when hearing about what happened today. And yes, of course, the gun law is so very different in France than it is in the US. And those guns were not allowed near the premises of the Bataclan concert hall or anywhere in Paris. But they managed to have them in Paris and have them through somewhere. I mean, apparently going through the frontier between Belgium and France without being checked for what they had in their boot because of the Schengen agreement, when you can go from country to country without being searched or anything. So that's the problem is very different. It's not that guns are allowed or not allowed and you can do whatever you want with your gun. It's not allowed. But there are ways to have guns, and the laws in France and in Europe has to be about how to make sure that there's not a black market, or has to close the black market for arms, because we know there is a black market for arms. That's how all those terror attacks can happen. So the law are there. The enforcement is another issue, of course, and finding out where these black markets are and how those people manage to get hold of those arms without being noticed is an entire issue. Basically, I think it's somehow more complicated because it's under the mantle. So as with everything, when it's not allowed, people do it anyway, and it's harder to stop.
Tim, much of the debate in America has been about, you know, the bad guys who want to come in from, you know, whether it's, you know, a Sudan or an Iraq or a Syria. But it turns out that lots of the bad people live in the United States. But there doesn't seem to be ever this switch over to saying, okay, we have as much as a problem here with, you know, whether it's terrorism or not, we don't know, but with, you know, with people who certainly have some kind of psychopathic tendency. But again, there doesn't seem to be any attempt there. That's the strange thing. No attempt to kind of restrict those people in your own country.
There is an attempt to try and track people, but this goes to the heart of America, what it feels about itself, the right to bear arms, the Constitution, etc., etc. It always comes back to that. It's not going to be changed. You're right about the figures. I'm actually just been looking at them recently because I'm writing a book about divisions and walls. And so, of course, it took me to Arizona and Trump's wall. And nearly all the terrorist attacks that have happened in America are not from people that have infiltrated inside. Many of them are from people that were born there. And this, whether it's terror or not, is someone that's born. And when you go to the wider figures and the homicides each year, you know, overwhelmingly, massive proportions are committed by homegrown Americans against homegrown Americans. But that is a rational argument I'm giving you there. I'll therefore come back with an emotional argument. No, goddammit, I am an American. It is the basis of my constitution, that I can have the right to bear arms, which means I have the right to buy them. So of course we're going to have, yeah, well, maybe we should make it a little bit stricter that you can only get one at a time instead of five or whatever. Yes, we'll keep a track on bullets. Yes, we'll make it an even more jail time if you move your semi-automatic weapon and make it an automatic weapon, because semi-automatic, you can... You can change rifles so they don't just go single firing. You can do the bursts, and that he clearly had bursts of up to 30 rounds, which tells me he's not ex-military. You're taught not to go for you go short bursts, 10, 5, 10, 5, then you reload. This was just 30 at a time. Sorry, I've digressed. The point being that you are being rational, but the response to this is often emotional. And they're not going to give the guns up.
There's a side question, Marie, which is about, I guess, what would we give up to feel more secure and more safe? You know, in Paris, they have brought in many means of trying to control your entrance to venues and more checks and more levels of security. And I was struck at the weekend, I was doing lots of things in central London and had to cross, walking back and forth across various bridges. The barricades are up, these huge, like, you know, almost like tank traps at the beginning of each bridge that you have to filter through. You know, the CCTV cameras swivel on you. I walked past Parliament, the high level of policing with people with guns. You know, a real sense that this is, you know, a city that even people who lived here 20 years ago would not recognise and would have been made uncomfortable by. But the layers have been added one by one and the shifts have been so nuanced that you kind of don't notice it. But where for you, or where do you think in Paris that next bit comes when you think, do you know what, this has got to a level where, one, I wanted to stop, or two, I don't want to be here?
Well, the difference between London and Paris, and in fact the UK and France, is that we see policemen with guns. We see militaries. We've been seeing militaries for years in the stations, in the airports, with heavy guns, basically. So that's something that we are not shocked at all to see, because that's quite part of the normal life somehow. Yes, there are more now, and it's kind of impressive when you see so many of them in a station, in an airport. But again, that's not something too out of the ordinary, less so than it is in the UK, at least I'd say. The difference is that with the 2015 attacks, there was this emergency status that's been triggered in France. And it wasn't just the people and the militaries with the guns that shocked the French people. It was more the rights that were taken away from people who were suspected, or the right to search your apartment, basically, yeah, without any some kind of previous warrant or anything. The rights were more, the withdrawal of rights were more shocking, I think, to French people than the seeing of the guns, because this perhaps because it's emotional as well. Yeah. There's something in the rights of the French people that are more enshrined in their conscious national conscience than just seeing, you know, guns on the street.
Marie's point also speaks to your previous point about how life changes, or as John Lennon said, life is what happens when you're looking the other way. Life changes 1,000 ways over a decade, for example. And it's not just that the cameras are swiveling around and following you and the bollards have gone up to stop people mounting the pavements. It's also what you say about the laws. The laws change one after another. And then 10 years later, you realize you're not quite in the same country that you used to be. And this is what has happened in Europe over the past decade. And that is a direct response to terror. Now, we've moved on to terror and Europe. I mean, this ISIS has claimed this as one of their guys. It looks pretty unlikely at the moment. They say, oh, he can a few months ago. It doesn't look that way at the moment, but we have to have an open mind about it. And then you can have a debate about what is and isn't terror. Well, terrorists, if you're doing it for a political end, if he's just a man who's snapped, I don't think you call that terrorism. Either way, you have to do something about it, but they are two very different things. And in Europe, our countries, our laws, our ways of life have changed from 10 years ago.
But it's interesting, all those changes. I was in my car just like about a week ago. I was coming here to Midori House, and I watched these two kids on a scooter, and I thought, God, they're a bit lost because they came up on the wrong side of the road. And I was stopped at a zebra crossing, and they zoomed around on the zebra crossing. And then they went down a very wide pavement near Russell Square, and they managed to steal two phones within about 2 minutes off two women who were on the
scooters.
No, but what's interesting is, now, it was a very wide pavement. They could have been in a car. They could have taken out 50 people on their way to work. Or they could have had a bomb or a gun. And those kids were through the traffic and gone, and I'm sure have not been caught within seconds. So all of these PR-able things which are on the bridges, you know, they look fearsome, and they look as though they're controlling it. But whether you're sitting, you know, in the lobby of a hotel in Vegas, or whether you're trying to watch on CCTV camera what's happening in London streets, in the end, it's kind of impossible, isn't it, to stop it?
Yeah, but there's two things there. One is criminality, and you know, when the highwaymen used to rob stagecoaches, eventually they put people on the stagecoaches with a gun. You know, we always it is always response to problem, and that will never ever change. And that's criminality. For example, in this country, we're having a debate at the moment about whether caustic acids, you need to be of a certain age to buy them because they've become a weapon. That's a different thing, because that doesn't change society as much as terrorism laws and the things we do about terrorism, such as CCTV, such as infiltrating certain communities. That's what actually changes the makeup of the country. And that's why terrorism is, in fact, more dangerous than people think it is. They say, oh, well, more people get run over by a car. More people die in car accidents each year, which, of course, is true. But that doesn't fundamentally change the nature of British democracy or any other democracy that you're talking about. Terrorism does change it. And so that's why terrorism is much more corrosive to a society than often people believe.
And one of the interesting things was that the name of the attacker, Stephen Paddock, was released very, very quickly. I can go online, I can see aerial photos of his home, I can see who his girlfriend was, there's an interview with his brother, there's, you know, we know a huge amount of information about him already. If that had been in France, Marie, what would we have been given so much information? Because when you go to Germany and you read news reports in German newspapers, it can be days before they give you even the most basic facts, which especially is weird in a case which has international significance, because the name's reported outside of Germany, and any German can just log on and look at your website.
Well, it's true that the US tends to want to name the suspect quickly, and sometimes we see that the US want to name our suspects quickly, quicker than we would like to. But I don't want to be the advocate devil in a way, but I think, I'm not sure. Basically, the police arrived and saw this man who already apparently killed himself. He was a white guy. And I remember when the mosque attack in Finsbury Park happened in London, I was called in by one of my employers saying, but don't worry, it's not a terror attack. The guy was white. Or the guy ran over a Muslim, something like that. So basically, it was not a terror attack because of that. Perhaps somehow, maybe they thought he's white, so it might not be a terror attack. It's just one of those gun nuts, something like that. And in that case, there's no need to basically make sure that the accomplices wouldn't run away. Because if it was terrorism, of course, there's a possibility that there's some kind of network around it. If they kind of decided that's not terrorism, it's just a nut guy, we can just give his name and we'll have more information quicker. And we don't jeopardize the inquest. So that might be one of the possibilities. The other thing is that there's this wish to know everything in the US that's perhaps a bit more pregnant than in the UK or in Europe. If the authorities know something and they withdraw the information, that's something that's, I think, not well accepted in the US. So in a way, they are obliged to give the name quite quickly, because if they don't give the name, that might mean, one, maybe they withdraw the information. Two, that also means that if they don't know, we should we panic somehow? And also during the night, there was this name of a guy that was on social media and floated by far-right website on Twitter and on the internet. And they basically named the guy, saying he's the one who did the attack. He's a Democrat. He's a fan of the Rachel Maddow show, something like that. He has the same last name as the lady that was looked after, that was searched, basically. His name was Jerry Darnley. And people was... And of course, when you look for... when you Google something like, you know, the Las Vegas attacks, the algorithm of Google might show you this guy who has nothing to do with it. So in a way, somehow, people need to know, people want to know, and naming the suspect quickly, make sure that innocent people are not named, and also make sure that the population know that they are on the case.
Tim, there's a tension here in the UK. We've had a few recent incidents where people have thought, this is crazy, we should be given a little bit more information here. I know you don't want to prejudice cases, which is always another complicated thing here. But do you think we get it roughly right in the UK?
I think we get it roughly right here, and I think they get it roughly right in the States. I think most countries get it roughly right. It depends on each individual case that you're looking at and the culture of the country. If you look at the American today, firstly, you can't libel a dead person, and the guy was dead. Now, that's not an excuse, but it is a reason. Secondly, it is quite possible they just thought, we want to let people know we don't think this is a network. We don't think there's other shooters out there. We don't think that there's more to this and that tomorrow they're going to hit somewhere else. And they put his name out. And it was the officials that named him. It wasn't the media in this particular case. So I think you could justify it. Here, we've had some very unfortunate namings by media in various cases, criminal cases, which has turned out to be nothing to do with that person. And I think that is despicable and that shouldn't happen. Then you've got the other scenarios. In Barcelona recently, in the terror attack there, the man escaped. I mean, I think it's quite justifiable to say, we're not saying that person X, and name him, did this. However, he's a person of interest. We would like to get hold of him. Here's his picture. Here's his name. If you happen to know anything about him, I think that's completely justifiable when you've got the authorities who suspect that he's just killed 20 people and he's going to try and kill another 20 people. So I think it's quite justifiable to name people in those circumstances. You don't say they're the perpetrator. You say they are a suspect.
Well, there'll be more news from the shootings later on the Daily with Andrew Mueller. But for now, from Marie Bion and Tim Marshall, we're going to take a tiny, tiny break because we're going to come back and talk about Catalonia.
Visit our online shop where you can find items designed by our in-house team and collaborations with the brands that we love. Discover everything from luggage and clothes to stationery and back issues of the magazine, as well as our book series and popular travel guides. We deliver worldwide and offer high-quality customer service. And don't forget to let us know if you're a Monocle subscriber to enjoy your 10% discount. Go to monocle.com/shop and browse away. Or if you're in Tokyo, Singapore, Hong Kong, London, New York or Toronto, visit us at one of our shops and we'll take care of you personally. See you around!
This is Midori House, and still with me are Marie Bion and Tim Marshall. Catalonia's leader, Carles Puigdemont, says that the region has won the right to independent statehood following the weekend's vote. However, Spanish Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy says that Catalans have been fooled into taking part in what was an illegal referendum. There are now reports that Catalonia may declare independence within the next few hours. But beyond the legal and political details, what exactly does it mean to be an independent state? Marie, we should jump to you. You're a fascinating example here because you come from, your name sounds very French, but you're a Monegasque. You come from a tiny, small, independent country. Maybe you're proof to the Catalans that it can be done, with a good few casinos and some banking. But what does it feel like to be a Monegasque? Do you feel entirely independent or do you feel stitched into French life?
I'm just talking personally this time, I guess. I never felt somehow exactly Monegasque, even when I was little and growing up, because even, you know, in the classroom, I was most of the time the only Monegasque in the class. So that means that there are so few Monegasque that you might feel very special, or you might just blend in, basically. And in class, I wasn't taught about the Monegasque history. I was taught about the French history, because the curriculum is the French one. We depend on an academy, which is a French one. We, of course, don't have our own academy or not our own curriculum. So you're brought up, basically, to be French in all but name, and that's exactly how I feel. I feel French in all but name, although I know that, and I feel Monegasque for other reasons. I know that if things go south for me, for example, here in the UK, I can come back to Monaco, I can just say, hello, I'm here, and I'll have a job in the next few weeks, because there's this idea of the priority for Monegasque. So I'll never be homeless, and I'll never be out of a job for a long time. So that's what being Monegasque means, meaning that it's not exactly emotional.
But is there a little bit where, you know, there's a borderline where when you're with French people, they, you know, they assume that you're exactly the same. You're like, no, hold on. I don't eat that. I don't say that. I don't feel that. Is there a cultural break point or?
No, there's really not. Not from us. Not from Monegasque.
Even when they say, I can't afford that.
Well, the thing is, not from us. Most of us do feel French in many things. But I was so surprised when I arrived when I was 19 to study in France, in Nice, which is like 12 miles of Monaco, away from Monaco, so really not far. And people thought that I was, you know, super rich, having a villa and a swimming pool and a pony in my backyard.
I thought you were as well. That's where you're on the show.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
You're buying the drinks afterwards, aren't you?
See you next week, yeah, in Monaco, yeah. They thought that. And I mean, but you live 12 miles from here. Just come around and see for yourself what Monaco is all about. So we do feel quite French somehow. But the French people think we are very different unicorns. And talking about me personally and having my family being scattered around Europe, I was quite surprised when in my teenage years I learned that I'm not European, meaning I can't live anywhere I want in Europe. To be in the UK, I have to have a visa like any other non-European, which surprised a lot of people, including some people in responsibilities in the UK when I tell them that. And so I do also feel European, because Monaco has all the advantages of being European at the moment without the disadvantages of being European, if I may say it.
Tim, just quickly on this, because we're going to try and squeeze in a whole other topic in like 1 minute. But just tell me, if the Catalans declare independence in the next few hours, and if they manage to set up all those instruments of state, are they going to be fully free of their Spanish identity as well?
No, because Spain won't allow it. Spain does have, according to its constitution and its Supreme Court, the law on its side. I'm not sure they will. I think they will. They might move more slowly. And if they don't, if they do declare independence and try to set up the apparatus, but what we've seen so far from the outside police will get worse. And don't forget that there's an awful lot of people in Catalonia that don't want independence, and they would have a say as well. Very briefly, this comes down to a love of one's own, nationalism, and liberals and intellectuals, and I'm only one of those things, have a real problem with understanding nationalism.
We were talking about the pace of change, and for our last topic, Marie, Germany at the weekend started allowing same-sex marriages, and a guy called Karl Kreiler and his partner Bodo Mender made it official on Sunday. Are you surprised, actually, at these things which suddenly seemed like huge kind of like moments of change, actually when they happen, everyone just forgets it after like 5 minutes, thank God?
Well, yes, thank God somehow that they forget about it, but it's such a milestone for people to be able, for same-sex couple to be able to just be like everybody. That's something that's so very important. And being in a same-sex partnership means also, of course, a lot. You're allowed, you are recognized as a couple by the state, but being able to marry and be exactly the same as another citizen, well, not exactly, there's a few tweaks and there still there in Germany, but it means so much for people who just think, well, blimey, that's just so almost normal now to be with a woman if you're a woman, with a man if you're a man. Why do people still think they have the need to legislate to let us just be as everybody? So it's a milestone because it's important that it was recognized as not being normal so far. But hopefully, yes, it's going to be normal in 2 weeks' time, and that's great.
I also like it's now normal for monogast to say blimey. That's very good.
Yeah,
Tim, just a few seconds on this. Again, the pace of change.
It's a long time coming. Germany was completely ready for it. Merkel realized that and allowed it. They also, not just same sex, you can also at the same time, you can adopt now. One thing that's interesting, there is a clear division between East and West Europe, and it is almost exactly down the line of the Iron Curtain. And on one side of it, we've moved to that place. And on the other side of it, they're not really that close to it.
And there's the same dividing line for the AfD, of course, as well. Well, that brings us to the end of today's show. I think it was a very happy union between Marie Bion and Tim Marshall. Thanks very much for joining us. Today's show was produced by Ben Ryland. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and also by Alessio Delania. And our studio manager, Christy Evans. But for me, Andrew Tuck, thank you very much for listening and goodbye.